And first, I like to talk about something which I thought I talked about last time, but obviously I did not, seemingly. And just to show the connection, I want to talk about a different thing this afternoon. But the first one is about what I discovered just 2-3 years ago, that there is this expression which is, you might have heard it, and it's be with things as they are. You might have heard this before. And you might have told something to somebody and he said, be with things as they are. So you might imply from that phrase, be with things as they are, that actually you should not do anything, and specifically you should not inquire or change anything. But what is interesting is that this phrase is actually, I would say, is not a totally adequate translation for the term. Because that's what I discovered, the term is Yata Bhutan Nyanya Dasana. So that's from the ancient text. And so this Yata Bhutan Nyanya Dasana is where this be with things as they are come from. But it's kind of like be with things as they are is a little, I would say, too condensed to represent what it means. So, yata. So yata, it's Y-A-T-H-A, means as, according to. Bhutan, B-H-U-T-A-N, if you want to know this kind of thing, you don't have to, means actually a fact, actuality, real, or grow, become, born, produce. Nyanya, N-A-N-A, means knowledge. Dasana, connected to pasana, means seeing vision. So this actually means, you could literally say the knowledge and vision that accords with actuality, that accords with what is real. Or you could, in a way, a practical translation, to see and to know things as they happen, as they arise. This is a little different to be with things as they are. Because that one seems to tell us, don't do anything. It's terrible, it's awful, just be there. Go deeply into it. That's generally what we're told. When here is very different, it's more active, it's more inquiring. See and know things as they come to be. So basically it's encouraging us to investigate. It's encouraging us to inquire. So in a way, to see and know things as they come to be, as they happen, as they arise. And so basically it's trying to tell us to look into conditions, to look into conditionality. And personally, I would say the reason for that is actually that by, and that thing, that's why inquiry is so important, is because if we experientially really know how things come to be, then actually we're going to be very different with them. And so it's very important to see that the inquiry is really into how things arise, how things happen, how things are conditioned. And personally I would say is when we really know experientially, like, you know, you mentioned the itch, and then you knew experientially the change. And if you can take one thing from this day, it would be, if something happened, to have this question, how long is this going to last? Instead of thinking, I am stuck, this is like this, this is forever. Instead of reacting in that fixing way, to have that more exploratory way. How long is this going to last? And instead of going into the thought about it, going into the experience of it. And why I'm talking about this is because personally I feel that this is actually the root of compassion. Wise compassion comes actually from inquiry. Of course, we need to have the stability, the grounding, the calmness. But the calmness in itself is not going to do very much. And so from that calmness, we all need to cultivate the inquiry, the investigation, the exploration in the experience. And the more we know it, that's why the yatta, bhuta, jnana, dasana is see and know things as they come to be, which means to really be inside the experience. And if we really know for ourselves, then it really changes the way we are. So it's not like thinking about it, I must be like this, I must do this. But it's really having kind of in a way integrated it in ourselves, this knowledge, this vision, then actually change the way we look at ourselves and others and we relate. And so basically what we're investigating, what we're seeing and knowing is basically what is often referred as the three characteristics of impermanence, dukkha, and anatta, not self. And so let's look at that. Impermanence, change, has two aspects. The first one is what you call ultimate impermanence, which is death. And to me, if you really know, my teacher used to say, your life rests upon a single breath. But do we live as if our life rests upon a single breath? Not really. We generally take life for granted and we distract ourselves and etc. etc. We go on a lot on automatic pilot. And so that's why I think we must be careful not to use impermanence as fatalism. Because sometimes it can be used that way. A vase gets broken, who cares? It's impermanent. You know, especially if it's not mine, I care even less. And I think we have to be careful in terms of the way we see and know the impermanent. Because to me, I really saw the difference when I saw my father die. I saw the last breath, and then it was just like, then I really knew impermanence. But then it totally changed me, that suddenly arose compassion. Compassion for myself and others whose lives rested upon a single breath. And so I started to look at them in the now, in the here and now, instead of the idea I had of them, the history I had with them. And personally, it changed totally my relationship to my mother. Because once this happened, then I met my mother where she was as a human being, instead of the whole history and whatever I had with her. And then it made a big difference to how I was with people. Was I in the relationship in terms of what I was hoping from them or what happened or etc.? Or am I in the relationship with this person in this moment? How they come to be in this moment? Can I be with them in this moment? And to me this makes relationship in a way more precious, and also we are more present to them, because you don't know when you're going to disappear, they're going to disappear. So in a way, really appreciating them right then, right now. Another aspect of change, impermanence, is things change, but we don't really live as things change. You can just notice when you say always or never, then you're not in seeing and knowing things as they come to be. You are in, it's always like this. It will never be like this. You always do this. You never will change. And if you think like this about yourself and others, it really is fixing and limiting for yourself and others. I mean, I have a nephew who kind of is a little kind of anxious and thing of that nature. But what is interesting with him is that sometimes he kind of suddenly see and know what's going on, although he doesn't do meditation. And then he decides to change. And so recently he was really, really anxious a few years back. And then his girlfriend was not enjoying him being so anxious, and so she kind of decided to make still together a little space. And that helped him to think, wait a minute, what is my priority? Is my priority to work so hard that I get so anxious that I don't have time for my girlfriend? Or is she a bigger priority and then I have a different relationship to my work? And it totally transformed him. Now he's not anxious, he does the best he can in the job, and so be it. And then he has more time for himself, for the girlfriend, and for his life, and he's much more calm. But if we think, if I think, oh, he's always anxious, he will always be anxious, that's the way he is, you know, who cares? But to me, each person, at some point, has the potential to change. And to me, this is a compassionate move. To know, even if the person right now seems to be a little stuck, it doesn't mean that they're stuck forever. If I seem a little stuck, it doesn't mean that I am stuck forever. So in a way, to me, this is what is so important in knowing change, is that then you can turn to this question, how long is this going to last? How long am I going to be this way? How long is that person going to be this way? And then you get, and it gets creative, into the conditions. In what condition am I like this? In what condition am I like that? In what condition are they like this or that? And so it's kind of like things can shift, can move. So again, to me, this is seeing and knowing and seeing, which actually helps us to be more compassionate, more creative, more open. Then you have the next one. The next one is called dukkha. And dukkha can be generally translated as suffering. There is somebody who's translated as stress. And actually it has three meanings, this word dukkha, that is so important in Buddhism. One meaning is unreliable. And it just means that because things are impermanent and changing, then you cannot rely on them to stay the same forever. So it's just like kind of like, so it's seeing and knowing that. If you see somebody changing a bit, like, you know, one moment they are with you and they're so happy to be with you. And so you think they are happy because of you. And then they're still with you and then next moment they're not happy. And you think, but it's my fault. You know, they should be happy, they're with me, but the fact that you are there doesn't mean that they will be happy all the time. It depends on many different things. So unreliability is just knowing that things can be relied upon, but not necessarily. I mean, you were lucky I managed to be here. Because this week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, there was a strike in France. The plane strike. And then there was also at the same time you had a train strike. But so I thought, but Friday seemed to be okay. So I was a bit late, but I got here. So, you know, things are unreliable. Striking, volcano, all kind of thing can happen. So it's kind of saying, if you expect things to be reliable, then you get a little difficulty. If you see and know that they could be unreliable, then you're more creative when things change. Then the other aspect is unsatisfactoriness. And that is more to this tendency we have to assume or hope or want that at some point I will be satisfied forever after. When actually, we can be satisfied, but temporarily. And then it goes, and something else happens, and we can be satisfied again. So it's kind of not saying that you can never get no satisfaction, but that it's conditional. So it's kind of just looking at that. Because if we think I should be satisfied forever after, then actually we get kind of into trouble. And so the Buddha is just saying, if you see and know that things are not always satisfactory, then you have an easier way to creatively engage with them. And the third aspect is dukkha dukkha. And dukkha dukkha means physical pain, mental pain. So it's when there is pain. And it's about not that you must inflict pain on ourselves, but that to know pain, to know suffering. In a way, nearly to embrace suffering. So that actually, to me, from that arise compassion. Because if we know suffering for ourselves, and not trying to escape it all the time, first we know that it comes and goes. The suffering also is impermanent and conditional. But in terms of compassion, we know two things. When there is suffering, pain, is that it's painful and it's isolated. And if we know that for ourselves, then we can have more compassion for ourselves and others. So I think to me this is a very important part about knowing, being in tune with our body, our mind, our heart, that we can know when I suffer, it's like this. When other people suffer, it's also like that. And so out of that arises compassion for our pain, for other people's pain. And then the last one is anatta. Anatta, which often is translated as no self. But my husband, Stephen Batchelor, preferred to translate as not self. It kind of gets a little language thick here. But basically, anatta doesn't mean that there is no self. That's right at that level. It's not a helpful translation. What it means, so it doesn't, it's not about us not existing. It's not about us not having any personality. But it's about us not reducing ourselves to any of the conditions that forms us. So basically the Buddha is saying we are not just our thought, we are not just our feeling, we are not just our sensation, we are not just our consciousness, we are not just our outer condition. Basically he's saying there is either in us, there is no place where this self can reside, because it's changing, moving all the time. But also it cannot, I think it's two aspects. One thing is that there is nothing that is it, but also that there is nothing it can be reduced to. And that I think in terms of the seeing and knowing, and I think that's what we can explore this afternoon, is selfing. How do we self, and how does that can be painful, or can be restrictive, or can be limiting? And so one way to see that is when we, in a way, reduce ourselves to one of the conditions that forms us. We have a thought. This is my thought. I mean, the one way to really know it is when you have a discussion with somebody who turns into an argument. So you talk about this and that. Or I don't know if you talk about your favorite football team, or, I don't know, rugby, or if you talk about the greatest idea in the universe, or whatever it is. You have a discussion, you think this, he or she think that, you think the opposite, they think this. And very quickly it becomes an argument. Because, and generally you get to have a little kind of tension and a little upset, you know. And what happens generally is that you identify with your idea. So my idea is my idea, it's me, and it's the best idea, it's the only idea. And so if this person criticize, question my idea, they're actually questioning my identity, my existence, when actually they're not questioning your existence or your identity, they're questioning your idea. And then what is an idea? An idea is actually just a little firing in the brain. That's it. Just a little chip. That's it. And then you might find, because of that, just little firing. And you think your firing is better than their firing. Basically, that's what it comes down to when we argue about this kind of thing. And so in a way, what the Buddha is trying to say is that we don't need, it's actually an obstacle, it's actually caused suffering, to identify. It doesn't mean we don't have soul, we don't have feelings, we don't have sensation. He's saying we cannot be just one of these things. We cannot reduce ourselves to that. And what is, and the problem with this reduction to an idea, to a feeling, to a sensation, to a situation, to whatever it is that generally we identify and solidify around what we identify with. So in a way, I mean, it's kind of like trying to it's like if I was trying to contain all this water in that glass. So I'm trying to push all this water in that glass and it must stay just there. But it's impossible. If I pour the water in the glass and want just to feed the glass and stay in the glass, it doesn't work. It goes all over the place. And it's the same when we try, when we grasp and identify with one thing, then actually we reduce ourselves, and it's so painful to do that. So, and when we do this to others, it's also very painful. You're just like this. That meaning you cannot be anything else. When we often upset about something somebody does, it's about one thing that they do. But because we're upset of that one thing they do, everything about them is terrible. It's generally, but just the one thing. Seeing and knowing it's just that one thing that is problematic, not the whole person. The same, not the all of us. So I think the not self is about that. It's about seeing how we self, and how in that selfing there is this kind of like two things which happen. There is often a limitation, and then also there is like a self-centering, bringing everything back to ourselves. That's in a way the problem with the selfing. Of course we have to self, because nobody is going to self for me, you know. So I am the only one who can self for myself and produce a self. So the anatta, the not self, is not about saying there is no self. There is a self which is built over time through conditions and different things. But that selfing is kind of like, you know, slightly temporary, slightly conditional, slightly also exploratory. You can expand it in many different ways. That's what it's saying. That actually it's more like a movable feast than something very fixed and solid. And so then through the yata bhuta nyanya dasana is seeing and knowing about the selfing. How do we self? What do we do with that selfing? Because the more we have this feeling, you know, myself, and the more we kind of like conglomerate, kind of get stuck around that selfing, then actually the less we can see others. This is one of the problems with selfing, is that it's also this kind of like, you know, self-centered. We become self-centered, and then we cannot see outside of ourselves, and then we cannot see others. And so that's one of the things about anatta, is not for us to disappear, but actually is reduce the self-centeredness so that then there can be more seeing, more awareness of the others. So to me, again, the anatta is very connected to compassion, to loving kindness, to rejoicing, to seeing the other, to being with the other, to relating to the other. And so in a way, what to me is very interesting in terms of the inquiry, in terms of the selfing, is to notice gently how we self. Is that we kind of, because we, it really happens on automatic. And a lot of it is to do, actually the selfing is made in many different ways. One is with the thought, one is the way we feel, and have this kind of habitual way of feeling. Also the way we kind of, you know, have physical sensation in the body, we kind of have a certain identity. I am somebody who has sciatica, but I don't always have sciatica. But if I see a little pinch, do I go, ah, I'm going to have sciatica, this is dreadful, this is terrible, or, be careful, be aware of how you move or thing of that nature. So in a way, it's kind of like this anatta is actually not a negating of ourselves, but is an encouragement to explore what makes the self, how the self is constituted. And what is interesting at that level is to look a little at the way we think and the way we feel, and how we, in a way, through that, start to kind of solidify around a certain sense of identity. I am an anxious person, I'm an angry person, I am a happy person, whatever it might be. And in a way to see that the way we feel, although we can have a tendency to be this way, that way or another, change according to conditions. Anatta basically is about conditionality. Not self is about actually that we formed, influenced by different conditions. Inner condition meeting outer condition. So what is interesting to try to do, and that's not so easy in meditation, but I think it's interesting to notice, to see. I mean, there is two ways we can work with inquiry in terms of selfing. So, I mean, one of the way of the Buddha, but then is it too didactic? That's for you to see. One way of the Buddha is to see, I am not myself, does not reside in my perception, in my physical sensation, in my thought, etc., etc. So I am not just my thought, I'm not just my feeling or my sensation of this or that and another. And the reason for that is because they change. So you cannot make your identity reside on something that is changing. That's basically one of the arguments about the Buddha, about not self. So one of the things we can do as we sit in meditation is actually we can try just to do what we do in meditation, observing the breath, the body or the sound, listening to the sound. And then what we kind of gently explore, and we could maybe do this for the first sitting of the afternoon, is observe the thought. But can we observe the thought without judging the thought? That's the key. In terms of like, there is four foundations of mindfulness, and the first one is being aware of the body, the second one being aware of the feeling tone, and the third one is basically mental factor. And that can be looked at in different ways. But one way can be to be aware of our thought. What is interesting if we try to be aware of our thought when we meditate is that generally there is no thought. So try it. See? Look at my thought. Generally there is just awareness. Because we decide to look at the thought, then there is just what we see is just awareness. And then if you try to do it for a little while, then we start to have thought, because of course the mind is going to be distracted. So then what can be interesting is to notice, what do I think? Because that's a law of what makes ourselves. Ourselfing is how we think. What do I say? When I sit in meditation, what is it I think about? Where do I go? Do I think just about me? Do I worry about others? And one thing the Buddha does in one of the sutta is very interesting in terms of selfing. He suggests, in terms of the seeing and knowing, to notice, and that's what you could try and play with, if it's not too complicated. As you think, as you find yourself thinking about something, being distracted, being in a story or in a plan or whatever it is, am I comparing myself to other in such a way that either I feel I am superior to this person or I feel I am inferior to this person, or I feel I am equal to this person. Because it's something we do generally very automatically in daily life. We meet somebody and generally we rank them. They're a little above, they're a little below, they're equal. And according to that, we might kind of plan to meet them in a different way. Or we might meet them in a different way. I remember many years ago, there was this, I won't mention names, but let's say there was this teacher, police teacher. And first I met him in ordinary circumstances, insofar he did not know I was anybody. And so since he did not know I was anybody, I was nobody for him, and so he ordered me like a lackey, go and get me this. Like, you know, quite dismissive. And then 2-3 years later, I meet the same person, but in very different circumstances. Now I am in, not Buckingham Palace, but the another of the palace in London, the one which belongs, I think, to the son of the Queen, Prince Charles. I don't know what the name of that palace is. So anyway, I was there for some do, and there I was kind of slightly an important person. And so the same teacher sees me and is obsequious. And me, I thought it was so funny, you know. Before I was really down, now it looks like I moved up. I was the same person, I had not changed. His perception of me, I changed. And I've noticed that in history, you know. So in a way, this is a kind of a really some the way we kind of self is often very immediate. Of course, it's a survival mechanism. I need to know, you know, where am I? It's kind of like a tribe thing and a kind of a human thing. But in terms of looking, that as soon as we, you know, we introduce this superior, equal, inferior, we become self-conscious. And we become conscious of the person in a very specific way, instead of in a way creatively engaging with the human being here and now. And that, I think, is interesting to look at. So as you look at your thought, the one thing we can notice is that, oh, my thought about me. A lot of the time, what we think, you're sitting there and you think about, you know, what I'm going to eat, what am I going to do? I mean, do you think about something else? That to me is interesting. Can we think about something else than just us? Or maybe, could we not think about us? This, so in a way, playing with that notion, not judging that I think about myself, I plan this, plan that, I'm generally the heroine or hero of my little mind, but noticing what shape does it take, how is it, can I shift it, can I think about somebody else? If I think about somebody else, do I think in terms of superior, inferior, equal, which then will dictate a little how am I going to behave toward them? Or think about them. So just kind of looking, trying to see, can I introduce a little of that inquiry in the thought, but not that it provokes proliferation, but more that it helps me to creatively engage with the thought, to actually inquire in the thought. Do I need to think this? Do I need to think this way? Can I think otherwise, can I not think it? So in a way, it's kind of like exploring that dimension of our experience. So that's what I would suggest, in a way, to try to do for the first meditation. Then the second meditation, because we're going to do, again, one sitting, one walking, one sitting. And the second one, I want to introduce something very different. In a way, a very different way to do inquiry, which is something I practiced for many years in Korea. I was a Buddhist Zen nun in Korea. And so for 10 years in Korea, I sat in meditation and did something extremely simple. Just asked, what is this? What is this? To me, this is ultimate meditation and inquiry. But the challenge with this practice is that it's not about thinking. it's really not about thinking. It's not about analyzing. It's not about psychology. It's not about the meaning of our existence. So it's not philosophy. But it's really experiential. The idea of this practice is that just to ask in this moment, what is this? So that actually we develop a sensation of inquiry. We actually develop an inquiring attitude. So when we ask what is this, we are not looking for an answer. This is a challenging thing, because generally we ask a question, we get an answer, next question, next answer. So we really have this idea that, in a way, the more I think, the more I'm going to solve something. And actually, this practice is nearly the opposite. Don't think, just question. And you know, just stay with the question. So, and it's really, in a way, helping us. That practice I see very much as helping us to be more flexible, to be less solidifying, less identifying, and really asking, what is it? And so to me, it's in a way another facet of how long is this going to last. It's just a different way to do it. And so you sit in meditation, and we can do this a second sitting if you want. What is it? And so the idea is that actually the sentence, the phrase, what is this, is an anchor. So that's what we come back to if you become distracted. But we're not repeating the phrases like a mantra. We're not, what is this, what is this, what is this. No point. So we're trying to imbue the question with this questioning, with this perplexity, with this wonderment. What is it? And so you might ask me, but what are you asking about? You know, what is this? What does it represent? And actually, it doesn't represent anything. It's actually just a way. It's nearly like you could see the what is it as just a question helping you to open to the whole moment. I mean, if you say, what is this to this moment? I mean, it's too big, you know. The room, you, each of us, me, I mean, so many different things. So this question is helping us not to pinpoint, but just, what is this? And opening to the whole existence. And its mystery, with its changing, with its unreliability, with its conditionality. So it's opening to it, but without defining it. That's why it's about questioning, and it's not about answering. So that's what I would suggest we do. First, we try to work a little with the thoughts, and then we try to work a little with the question. Any question, or is it relatively clear?
That sounds very challenging.
The questioning.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's
so,
like, what is what?
Yeah, I know. So,
I will go with the flow.
Yeah. But so, first, one thing about this questioning practice is that what I have been teaching it for a while, and I've noticed there is three types of response to it, like relationship to it. The first person loves it. It really gives some energy to the practice, really brightens the practice. Others, the second type of people, what is this, what is that, what? Why I'm asking this stupid question, then drop it. You don't have to do it. And you can come back to the breath, to the sound, because you can inquire in a different way. Just being aware of the change, being aware of the selfing is as good as a question. Then there is a third type of person, if they ask a question, it makes them a little anxious. And then I would say, don't do it too much. So basically, the question is about being with uncertainty, being with unknowing, becoming a little more, a little less kind of solidifying to a little more opening. And so this, I would say, do with the listening, do with the breath or the body, and just time to time, drop the question once or twice in the 30 minutes. So that's what I would suggest. But it's also very good to do during the walking. When you do walking meditation, you can also bring the question, or when you do the walking meditation, of course, you can bring just a little this seeing and knowing about the thought. You know, not in a kind of nasty judging way, but more in a exploratory way. You are walking in meditation. Why am I thinking about this? Not in terms of, you know, psychologically 10 years ago, but more, oh, questioning the thought itself. To me, this is one thing which can be very useful. Is this true? Can I think a different way? Can it take a different shape? So you can also explore that during the walking. So, shall we do it? So if we just again stand a little,